To be here, and thank you so much for taking time out of your Saturday to learn about all these amazing topics. I was going through the brochure in the backstage, and it's just so amazing to think about all the interesting energy and challenges that you all are here to tackle. I'm super impressed and really feel honored to be part of the conversation here. This is my second time engaging with the global effective altruism community. I went to the very first effective altruism meeting that was one of these EAGX things in Prague, in the Czech Republic, a couple of years ago. And, you know, it was really just a new community taking on this new concept in the Czech Republic, and I came away from there really energized. It's part of what made me want to come back here to talk with you all. And, you know, when I started to think about, well, you know, am I an effective altruist? You know, what does that mean for thinking about what I do and my beliefs? You know, the phrase that came and stuck into my mind and that I sort of made my Prague talk about was this concept of hard head and soft heart, the mindset that really unites us all as effective altruists, whether you work on international development, which is what I do, or on some of the other topics that you all are engaged on this weekend. And so in my current role, where I partner with governments to think about effective development finance, you know, I think the mindset translates into continuing to ensure that, you know, philanthropy and government resources are spent as effectively as they can be, where we want to use evidence to guide where we can achieve the greatest good at the least cost. And it also leads us to realizing, at least in my field of international development, that we need to find new and innovative solutions to our existing challenges. So, as I said, my visit to Prague made me really excited to continue this conversation. There I talked a little bit about sort of what works in development and how do we know that. And today I actually want to talk about engaging with the private sector from an effective altruist perspective and really advance my own thinking around this identity a little bit further. So I guess I want to begin by saying that, you know, no matter how evidence-based our model is, and, you know, I'm as randomista as they come, our current approach to development finance will not solve the complex challenges that we face. And I'm going to use this picture to illustrate a little bit of that in just a moment. When we think about foreign assistance, development assistance, we generally deploy grant-based aid on one hand, and to make investments in private companies seeking essentially commercial rates of return on the other. We don't, as a general rule, deploy all of the tools that are available in the development finance toolkit. We're not using scarce and valuable aid money to crowd in other capital to help solve the challenges that we face. And I'm going to argue in a few minutes that the world has changed sufficiently. Where poverty is and what poverty looks like has changed a lot, such that we need to begin to look through that toolkit and figure out other ways to support international development assistance. This is particularly important in an area of increasing concern for developed countries or rich countries, and that's fragile places. So fragility is sometimes used as a shorthand for post-conflict, but I'm using the term here in the more sort of formal definition, which is places where norms, institutions, rights, regulatory regimes are weak. And those are places where bankers say that country risk is high. When country risk is high, the required risk-adjusted rate of return that private capital needs to invest is also extremely high. And that means that flows of private capital are low. If we are looking to build out the private sector, that engine of jobs, that engine of inclusive economic growth, we've got to figure out how to improve our ability to invest in those kinds of places. And one of the ways to start to think about how to do that is by thinking about social return in addition to financial rates of return. And when you place increasing weight or value on social returns, the case for investment changes. That's the model that we've adopted at GIF. We call ourselves a social returns first investor. And that's kind of an effective altruism approach to supporting the private sector, engaging with the private sector, particularly in fragile places. It's how we help the governments that back us to direct their resources to take smart risks in ways that aren't typical with your grant-based funding or with the kinds of instruments we have where we seek commercial rates of return. So I'm going to dig into that a little bit more, and I want to tell one quick story to help us to do that. This is the story of Lively Minds. So this Lively Minds is a grantee of GIFs who are working in northern Ghana. Northern Ghana is a pretty fragile place, and women and girls fare especially poorly there. Just 44% of young women living in that region are literate. And the intervention, or the program that Lively Minds implements, works with exactly these young women by involving community mothers in the delivery of kindergarten classes, kids ages 4 to 6. And there's randomized control trial evidence suggesting that not only does this improve cognitive outcomes for those kids, it reduces teacher absenteeism, and interestingly, it empowers local, these often illiterate women. I've heard the stories firsthand myself of mothers who, and now, yeah, this is anecdata, but it's pretty compelling to hear women tell you stories about how they, being engaged in the education of their children has made their self-esteem rise and their level of empowerment in the household and community change. Okay, but Lively Minds is a social enterprise registered as a nonprofit. We've got a very difficult road to scale. The right path to scale is some kind of public-private partnership with the government of Ghana, or perhaps some kind of franchise model. But you need buyers with not only willingness to pay, but ability to pay to do that. And it's pretty hard to imagine that the kind of returns are there on the financial side that would make this interesting from a traditional investor's perspective. From the social impact, if that's what you look at, the case for supporting this is strong. In Accra, in the capital of Ghana, when I was there visiting Lively Minds, I stopped by a place called the Impact Hub. This is a totally different kind of a place. And it's an incubator founded by an amazing guy called Will Senyo, and it feels just like the WeWork, where my office is in London. These are innovative entrepreneurs working there, trying to tackle social problems, interesting ways of bringing the global capital to Ghana and make money, generate jobs, change the world. Sounds probably like some of you all who are in this room. But growing these businesses is going to be a very long road to hoe if we rely on the Ghanaian capital markets. I asked my RA to quickly check, like, what's the average rate for if I want a loan from the Bank of Ghana when I was getting ready to come here. And last week it was 34.5%. Cost of capital is high. And there's not a flourishing market of venture capitalists, local venture capitalists, or patient investors. And Ghana is not alone in a place that has both this and Will Senyo's incubator. Increasingly, that's what the world looks like. And that means we need to think about supporting development differently. Neither Lively Minds nor the Impact Hub is a traditional recipient of aid money from DFID or USAID. And increasingly, it might be that to help the clients and women who work with Lively Minds, you might do it through the path of supporting one of those firms or the Impact Hub itself. We've got to think about how to do things differently. We want this kind of impact from our development assistance. We've got to think about how to do that in a changing world. I'll show a few slides about what I keep saying about this changing world. As you all know, we have made amazing progress in reducing extreme poverty and increasing literacy around the world. Hundreds of millions of people's lives have improved over a relatively short time horizon. Increasingly, where poverty does exist, it's in these fragile places. Poverty is concentrated in fragile pockets of middle-income countries, and by 2030, something like 80% of the extreme poor are going to live in fragile places. This complicates thinking about how to support the private sector as this engine of growth and development. Development finance institutions, so that's CDC, OPIC, those kinds of entities. In 2016, they sent 10.6% of their funding in the world's most fragile places, and that's the DFIs. Private foreign direct investment is even smaller than that. So, as this development landscape has evolved, has our tools in our toolbox evolved? Not as much as it probably needs to. Most of us, I think more about DFID than we think about CDC in the UK context when we're thinking about development assistance. Same USAID in the United States. And DFID and USAID spent $30 billion on official development assistance in 2016. And that is important, highly valuable money that responds to, supports global public goods, responding to disease outbreaks, humanitarian disasters, improving the public health and security of poor people. And I am by no means arguing that this kind of ODA funding should be reduced. Development finance institutions, so that's CDC and OPIC and those kinds of places, those support infrastructure and the vibrant private sector, converting public money into private investment in the emerging markets and making some real money while they do it. OPIC brought in $358 million, more than it spent in 2016. The IFC, that's the International Finance Corporation, part of the World Bank Group, their annual surplus averages something around $600 million. And from that same CGD report that I just told you about, above when I mentioned that DFIs spend most of their money in non-fragile places, about 26% of their money goes to upper middle income countries and something like 8% in the poorest countries. So we've got ODA for fragile places, we've got DFI money going mostly to middle income places, and both of these are critical, but I think you can see that we're going towards thinking about there's some kind of a gap. And the gap is something that I call, and I think it came first from the MIDIAR network this term, funding in the pioneer gap. Traditional aid agencies and DFIs have really not been good at taking the risk in this early stage, supporting entrepreneurs with innovative ventures, entrepreneurs who may have been able to scramble together that first set of money to test out an idea, to pilot, to see if there's a there. But pioneers need more money to validate their idea and transition their innovation to a scalable, bankable project. And this pioneer gap can quickly turn into a chasm for entrepreneurs that are trying to build the market that they're selling into. And that's because of what economists call a bit of a market failure and some externalities. The externality here is that success for these pioneers benefits many companies, not the individual firm alone. But those benefits are hard to quantify, and they're hard to privately capture. So how can you demonstrate that you're investment ready to funders that are interested solely in the private financial returns? If we can figure out smart ways to accept concessional financial returns and trade for outsized social value, then funding to bridge the pioneer gap is the new tool in the development toolkit that we can add to the range of things that we're able to offer to support and improve the lives of poor people living in fragile places. Impact investors and venture philanthropists have been thinking about doing this for some time now. But those pools of capital will be most powerful if we can complement their work with some of the government budget commitments that currently rest at the two ends of this continuum. So I'll illustrate a little bit of how this can work in practice by introducing you to an entrepreneur by the name of Kola Masha. So when Kola founded his company, he had a vision of not just a profitable business, but one that would improve the lives of smallholder farmers in northern Nigeria. Babangona provides end-to-end assistance to farmers so that they get their crops to market and get the best price at the best time. But to make that happen in a very difficult context, Kola needed capital that was early stage, flexible, and patient. For his early stage capital, he actually got his first round of funding, mostly in the form of grants from a small Bay Area family foundation. This was well before any of this was commercially viable, but the grant money helped Kola to demonstrate that he could execute and refine in the earliest stages of his business model. Second, Kola needed flexible capital because Bob and Gona provides credit to the farmers in their network throughout the harvest season and has large capital requirements to operate. But international capital, commercial capital, including from the DFIs, is generally dollar denominated. And Kola is operating in a context in which currency risk is significant. So GIF, we made our investment in Bob and Gona, denominated essentially in the local currency. We took a subordinate position, accepted currency risk along with in the debt that we provided to Bob and Gona, and that allowed other more risk-averse dollar-based funders to come in a senior position. That meant that Kola had access to more capital more quickly than he otherwise would have if a funder like GIF had not been able to take on that kind of currency risk. Kola also needs patient capital. What he's trying to do is pretty hard, and returns, while they might be attractive, are coming over a relatively longer time horizon. And many, in fact, investors actually have closed-end funds. So that means they're looking to exit and they're looking for returns for their limited partners in a relatively short period of time. That can make even the most socially minded impact investment funds hard to match up with business models like the one that Kola is developing. GIF has been set up deliberately as an evergreen structure and an evergreen vehicle. So we're not going to face incentives to encourage Kola to go upmarket in his clientele to make his firm more attractive to other investors relatively quickly. We need more evergreen structures like that to develop, to support entrepreneurs like Kola. So looking to the future, if Bob and Gona works, it can support hundreds of thousands of jobs in northern Nigeria, and not just improving livelihoods, but putting a small dent in some of the root causes of a long simmering conflict with Boko Haram. So, of course, this kind of approach is not without its challenges and not without its risk. Using public money to support private entrepreneurs puts us in that space of worrying about whether we're distorting markets or crowding out private finance when we really are interested in crowding it in. So there's a couple of lessons that GIF has learned that can be useful to mitigate these concerns. First, seek your investments in contexts in which you understand why social returns might not just be large, but should be large relative to private returns. So that means you're looking for places where there are market failures. And often this is because there's a missing market due to high costs of market discovery. Innovating in new markets might mean a long process of testing and experimenting to find the right product market fit and discovering the right cost structure. Firms' ability to capture the returns of that investment to do all of that learning is typically limited, and that's the kind of market failure where you can be more certain that you're actually crowding in other capital rather than crowding it out. Second, you've got to measure impact rigorously and discipline yourself to use evidence of impact as a positive screen on your investment decision making. You claim you want to find those places where social return exceeds financial return. You owe it to your own investors or yourself to really test that proposition to investing in measurement. So GIF has an approach to this that we call practical impact, which is lean, pretty flexible. We use the best available data and evidence to guide our investment decision making. And then we update our assessment and measure of the social value of our investments, just the same way that a venture capitalist needs to assess the valuation on the financial side of their portfolio on a regular basis. Of course, your concessionality, the subordinate position, remember, that we just took in the Bob and Gona case, that means we were subsidizing other investors effectively. That should be minimized, right-sized. You should understand what risk you're bearing, that it's difficult for the other investors to bear, and why that's an appropriate use of your capital. And, you know, this is that hard head, soft heart, again, approach to thinking about how to engage. And finally, meet the entrepreneur where they are. We talked about flexibility, being willing to come in early, being willing to be patient, and use different instruments, equity, debt, convertible notes. Meet the entrepreneur where they are on their journey. And so I will finish up here today by thanking you again for the opportunity to be here and to talk about these topics with you all. There are some interesting and new developments in this space that I think it's worth all of us keeping an eye on. I mentioned that Omidyar Network and other philanthropies have sort of lit the path, and not only is GIF now engaging in this kind of work, but the reforms of the USDFI OPIC seem to as though that modernizing that institution will allow them to engage more in this in the missing middle, if you will. Keep an eye on the IDA private sector window at the World Bank. And I urge you to, you know, seek opportunities to take smart risk in pursuit of social value with that hard head and soft heart. And keep this pioneer gap in mind, whatever that might mean for you, where you are as a investor and an effective altruist, and take some smart bets for social change. That's the effective altruism approach to impact investing. Thank you.
Want to sit down for a few questions?
Sure, I am happy to.
All right, so as always, you can submit your questions via the Bizibo app or on the website at london.eaglobal.org/polls, london.eaglobal.org/polls. A lot of great stuff there. I love the concept of making an investment in a junior position and just the general concept of crowding out, crowding in capital. Could you talk a little bit more about kind of how that dynamic plays out, like who are these other investors and what your relationship with them ends up being as these deals come together?
Sure. So sticking with the Bob and Gona example there, we weren't alone in taking on this subordinate position. We did that actually along with another couple of impact investors. And then the senior position would be taken by folks like OPIC or the IFC. So some of these development finance institutions. You know, and the ultimate vision, I think what would be really great is if over time you de-risk the model enough that ultimately it's funded in local capital markets in Nigeria. All his expenses and revenues are in local currency. You know, they do have a flourishing pension fund infrastructure there that, you know, that would be a real prize for that. One thing that is interesting about another role that GIF was able to play in that area was, you know, you needed to on the ground due diligence into this model. And many investors didn't feel like they had the capacity and the capability to really go and dig into this stuff in northern Nigeria in that context. So we agreed to do that work as sort of a public good that then could be shared with the other impact investors who were in our consortium at the subordinate position. So that's, again, another way of thinking about, okay, we're set up to actually tolerate this risk, which others can't necessarily do. And the more that you think about who can take on different kinds of risks, you can put these interesting coalitions together. So as a general rule, we invest with impact investors, DFIs, some true venture funds, local venture funds, sometimes with private equity. So we are able to be in different positions with interesting different partners.
A couple of questions coming in already. I'll combine two into one. How does your organization decide which organizations in turn to invest in? And can you give some examples of other organizations that you have already invested in?
Sure. So GIF was very deliberately set up to support innovation. And open innovation is at the heart of what we do. I didn't emphasize that so much here in terms of what I chose to speak about, but that's very much core to our identity. And so part of how we interpret that is by saying we don't have a sectoral focus. We don't have a geographic focus. We're really interested in accelerating evidence-based innovation that improves the lives of people who live under $5 a day. And so that's great. On the other hand, it's also like, okay, my goodness, where do you start then? And so we work really closely with networks of other co-investors, with accelerators and incubators, and really try and see what their entrepreneurs excited about, and then see how much we're backing an entrepreneur as much as we're backing an innovation. So that's sort of like a bottom-up approach as opposed to a top-down or strategy-driven approach, which, you know, oftentimes many strategic philanthropies elect to take that approach to investing their money. And we've deliberately complemented that with something more bottom-up.
So now
I was supposed to describe a couple of deals.
Yeah, please.
Let me see. Let me tell you about something I'm currently excited about. There's a real interest in international development in figuring out innovative ways that we can help governments to increase their own tax revenues. You know, the sort of jargon for that is domestic resource mobilization. And, you know, it's attractive both because you start thinking about this journey to self-reliance and graduating from international assistance, but it's also hugely empowering to local decision makers and local actors, you know, to spend money on what's their priorities, their money on their priorities. And so part of what you need to do to move the needle on domestic resource mobilization is help firms formalize, or even better yet, begin as a formal firm in the formal sector and never spend time in the informal sector. But in many contexts, that's actually hard. Even if the spirit is willing, paying your taxes as a small business in a place like Indonesia is daunting. It's a clunky, paper-based thing. It's hard. So we've recently taken an equity stake in a company called Online Pajak, who work with, it's like Quicken tax software, but for SMEs, and with a mobile app-based approach to it. And that's free to firms. The Online Pajak makes money by then selling you other services, like I can do your accounts payable, receivables, even some of your HR stuff, once you've put all of your data into the Online Pajak system. And what was interesting for GIF is that the other lead investor in this round was a private equity firm, who obviously have way deeper pockets than we have. And so we at first said to ourselves, great, domestic resource mobilization, I love it, but what else are we really bringing to the table? Because we're not bringing money to the table the way that this private equity firm clearly is. But in conversation with the firm, what we realized was that we could be valuable to them in kind of unique ways. First of all, one of our partners is the Australian government, and the Australian government is working with the tax authorities in Indonesia to improve regulatory reform efforts there. So we were able to facilitate conversations because of our relationship with the government of Australia that could help embed the Online Pajak kind of approach into larger tax conversations being had there. And then secondly, we were able to match them up with the behavioral insights team, who we had previously given a grant to do some kind of nudges around getting people to pay their taxes. And now we're able to think about nudges to use Online Pajak and how to think about marrying the technology and the behavioral economics, so maybe the whole's greater than the sum of the parts. And so we were able to say, actually, I do understand why we're taking a seat at this table alongside the deep pockets of this private equity firm. We're bringing something different and valuable and unique. And that's, I think it's a great example of how us being backed by governments is a feature, not a bug, and our wonky interest in evidence and economics can be valuable for the firms we partner with, too.
Awesome. at this point, way too many questions for us to get through them all. But you will have office hours coming up.
I will.
Immediately after this. So round up there for a chance to ask your questions and get into some discussion. Maybe we'll just end with one more, which is probably a relatively short answer.
Okay, I'll be short.
How would you recommend that someone get into your field? Would it start with a more traditional finance background or something else?
I think understanding markets and local contexts and the economics of the challenges that we're thinking about is just as important, if not more so, than being a financial wizard. And I think, you know, we work very collaboratively at GIF with, you know, local, you know, people with deep experience in how things scale up in developing countries, the economists on our analytics team and our finance folks all work super closely together. Because, you know, that the reason we were excited about Online Podjack is because of its contribution to growth and development. And most impact investors, or many, might say, "Is that an impact investment? You can't take a picture of the woman farmer that you're helping," you know, in part, but that's okay. And so it's exactly the richness of those conversations that help us do exciting deals like that. And so I think it's not just a traditional MBA, but it's something a little bit more magical than that.
We'll have to continue this conversation at office hours. How about another round of applause for Alex Peterson-Duane?